Gentlemen, since there are a number of correspondents who are not our regulars here, let me just go through the ground rules once again for everyone. Everything said at this conference, with the exception of opening remarks, which will be available for you at the close of the conference, must be treated in the third person until we can make available to you the official transcript of the conference. This, of course, holds true for film and for radio taping of what is said here.
One of the first of the urgent tasks to which President Kennedy turned his hand when he assumed office was that of fresh initiatives in our relations with Latin America. We asked the Congress for immediate appropriation of the $500 million for the Bogota Program for Social Progress, which had been recommended by President Eisenhower, and the $100 million for the Chilean earthquake relief. And we were very pleased that the Congress acted promptly on both those requests. Then you will recall that on March 13, the President addressed the Latin American diplomats at the White House, in which he put special attention upon the need for massive efforts to develop this hemisphere in its economic and social life, and developed that further in his address of April 14th at the Council of the Organization of American States. One of the most important stages in the Alliance for Progress has just been completed near Montevideo. The ministerial meeting of the Inter-American Economic and Social Council has just concluded its deliberations there and has laid the foundation for a greatly expanded effort in this hemisphere to get on with the great task of economic and social development. The United States delegation was led by our distinguished Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Douglas Dillon, and we're very pleased to have him as our guest today in order to be able to give you his comments on that meeting and to take your questions about how he sees the Alliance for Progress. Secretary Dillon.
Thank you, Dean. I have a brief statement here which I'd like to read first, and copies of which will be given to you afterwards, sort of setting the framework for what I think was accomplished at Punta del Este. I can say without reservation that the conference at Punta del Este was a complete success. The charter produced there, establishing an alliance for progress, marks an important turning point in the history of our relations with Latin America. We must now work together with the democratic leaders of Latin America to ensure that the great purposes of the charter will be accomplished and to ensure that its shining promise will become a reality for the millions in Latin America who urgently seek a better life. The Charter provides in full measure for those principles of self-help which are essential to economic and social progress in Latin America, for tax reform and for land reform, for self-help measures in education, in health, and in housing, for the mobilization of domestic resources, with the full participation of private enterprise. It also provides for the establishment by the Latin American countries of comprehensive long-term programs for economic and social development, with strong inter-American machinery to assist in the formulation of these programs, evaluate their adequacy, and follow their progress and execution. Such programs are essential to the intelligent use of economic resources in development. The Charter also provides for foreign assistance to Latin America from the United States, from international financial institutions, and from other friendly countries. Since my return from Punta del Este, I have been asked whether the leaders of Latin America have both the intention and the capacity to undertake internal reforms and other measures of self-help, which must be pressed forward if the Alliance for Progress is to succeed. The same question has appeared in our press. Recalling the spirit of dedicated drive and cooperation that prevailed at Punta del Este during the closing days of the conference, I can answer the first part of that question with an unqualified yes. The representatives of the other American republics demonstrated at Punta del Este that they are determined to bring increasingly more abundant and more meaningful lives to all of their citizens within the framework of free institutions. They are well aware that to achieve the goals they have set themselves, at least 80% of the funds required to meet these goals must be raised in Latin America. The charter we signed at Punta del Este, in truth, an economic Magna Carta for the Americas, fully attests to their intentions. As for the second part of the question, let me say with complete candor that their capacity to fulfill the spirit of Punta del Este depends in large measure upon what we do here in Washington and within the next few days. No matter how good their intentions, no matter how much national effort is brought to bear upon their enormous problems, the leaders of Latin America cannot translate their ambitious plans and dreams for their peoples into reality without financial and technical assistance from the United States, and on the long-term basis, which is indispensable to sound programming. We must recognize that questions about the future of the Alliance for Progress are not our prerogative alone. They are also being asked in Latin America about us, about our intentions, and about our capacity to help make the Alliance for Progress a success. These questions were raised in open meeting at Punta del Este by the representative of the Castro regime, who boasted that only their monolithic form of statism could produce progress, who derided the honest differences of opinion that characterized the democratic governmental process, and who predicted that because of our democratic form of government, our pledges at Punta del Este could not be relied upon. Some of our staunchest Latin American friends also told me that latent doubts about our intentions will not be resolved until we demonstrate our determination to help bring their impoverished peoples into the 20th century by providing financial and technical assistance on a long-term basis so that they may plan their own national affairs with some logical assurance of continuity in their programming. En route home, I also read these questions in the Latin American press. It is imperative, therefore, that we in the United States demonstrate our support for the Charter of Punta del Este, that we fulfill our irrevocable commitment to the Alliance for Progress by helping to accelerate Latin America's sweeping surge toward a better life and freedom for all of its citizens with adequate long-term foreign aid legislation. As President Kennedy said in welcoming the United States delegation home from Punta del Este on Saturday, this is a partnership. There is work in it for all of us, and the United States must surely bear its full share. Thank you. I'm ready for your questions.
Mr. Secretary, I wonder if you could assess the impact of Mr. J. Guevara's attendance at the conference and his subsequent meetings with the presidents of Argentina and Brazil.
Well, it certainly is easy for me to assess his impact at the conference. He perfectly clearly came there for a political purpose, and he made that clear right in the beginning by saying that you, in his first speech, that you couldn't separate politics from economics, and he made that clear all the way through the conference, and at the end practically stated that his real reason for coming there was to make sure that there wouldn't be a political conference to immediately follow the conference. He did try to throw hookers into the economic conference as it went on from time to time. These were invariably rejected. He found no support among any of the Latin American delegations for his actions. And I think generally, as the conference wore on, the delegates rather wearied of listening to this same song, which wasn't of any interest to them in the very serious work that they were trying to accomplish at Punta del Este. So I think that As far as interfering with that conference, he had no effect whatsoever. What effect he had on a future political conference is something the future will have to show.
Mr. Secretary, in regard to the congressional failure to act the Kennedy long-range program on foreign aid as sort of legislative repudiation of the Kennedy program?
I think that it would be very serious and it would be looked on very seriously in Latin America if we didn't come out of this present legislative process with adequate authority to commit loans on a long-term basis and assurance that they would be funded. Although this was the way the report of the action in the House was received on the last day in Punta del Este, it deeply disturbed many of the delegates there. The work of the conference was over, so it didn't affect the conference. It was the way it was treated in the press on the way home that I saw in Brazil and Venezuela, and certainly it is the way that it will be treated in Latin America, because it looked like it was confirmation of what Che Guevara had said earlier. But therefore, I sincerely hope that in the final result, we will have some system whereby we will have the ability to make these adequate long-term commitments to help carry out these programs. I certainly do. It was very clear, although a great many of these, the majority of the things in the charter dealt with governmental actions, since there were governments there, every one of the governments recognized that it was basically a private enterprise economy. There was a very strong statement on private enterprise in the declaration of Punta del Este, which was a statement that reads that one of the things that must be done is the alliance has agreed to work toward the following goals. One of them is to stimulate private enterprise in order to encourage the development of Latin American countries at a rate which will help them provide jobs for their growing populations, to eliminate unemployment, to take their place among the modern industrialized nations of the world. This particular paragraph was debated. The Cubans tried to get it changed by substituting some word like economy for private enterprise, because they said it's the whole economy that takes care of unemployment, and it was not changed, and the other countries voted unanimously to keep this thing. So I think that the spirit is very good, and we can look forward in the countries that are moving ahead the best for good opportunities for our private investment.
Secretary, Savvy Jagan won the election in British Guiana yesterday on record as saying he will apply for aid under this program. In view of the suspicious attitude of a lot of people of his political colors, would you tell us what this government's attitude would be in that case?
I think I better pass that one to the Secretary of State, because that's one we didn't have to handle down there.
Well, the election gave the party that Mr. Jagan was leading a clear majority, and presumably he will become the prime minister in the new government, which will be in the status of local self-government, but within the general framework of British responsibility for foreign affairs and for defense matters. This question has not been raised with us, and we will take a look at it if and as it comes up. But I think there's no automatic answer that can be given to that particular question today.
Actually, of course, British Guiana is not technically a member of the Alliance for Progress as yet, so they're not members of the Inter-American Bank, and so a great many of these things, they couldn't get aid anyway, even no matter what the decision might be.
Secretary, did you find support for our position on Berlin and Punta del Este among the
was never discussed. And
could you give us an annual breakdown of the 23rd?
An annual breakdown? $2 billion a year is... how's the $2 billion divided? Well, this is naturally a very rough figure, and as we pointed out, it was a figure that we feel is minimal, particularly if the alliance works as we expect it to and the countries develop, they will become more attractive for private investment and draw in more private investment. Now, the figures that I gave in a background conference down in Punta del Este, I think, are as good as any, although various ones can vary, $50 or $100 million one way or another. And the figures I gave were about $1.1 billion a year from United States governmental sources. This includes Export-Import Bank, Food for Peace, ICA grants, and the development aid that may go, and in addition, it includes the Fund for Social Progress, which would be carried out through the Inter-American Bank, but for which we provide all of the funds. The remaining $900 million we divided just roughly three ways, $300 for American investment, private investment in Latin America, which, based on the past, is a reasonable figure, $300 for the international institutions, which is the World Bank, the IDA, and also the Inter-American Bank from its own regular funds, which also I think is a fairly reasonable figure, and $300 from foreign public and private sources, which may, if anything, be on the low side, but certainly is, I think, a reasonable figure because foreign investment is increasing in some of the Latin American countries such as Brazil and Argentina.
Secretary, I'd like to ask the Secretary of State, if I may, a question recalling aid to Dr. Jagan. My understanding, Mr. Secretary, that British Guiana in the current fiscal year was talking about $700,000 of technical aid under ICA, but they also had their World Bank on about maybe a quarter.
No, I was simply suggesting that the question of aid policy in the light of the election or as a result of the election has not been up for consideration. We do not have new applications or new policies and new policy issues in front of us. We've been working with the British, as you know, on these earlier matters, and a good deal will turn upon what happens inside British Guiana and the policies and programs and activities of the new government there.
In other words, the aid we've been giving up to now is because we're safeguarding the British in control, right?
Well, that had something to do with it, yes.
Secretary, President Quadros has written Premier Khrushchev mentioning that or saying that U.S. aid to Brazil was not commensurate with their need or ability to absorb. I was wondering, did President Quadros or Minister Mariani say anything on the subject to you?
No, that was never mentioned, but it's been a long-standing Brazilian feeling that the aid that we have given over the past years has not measured up to their needs or to the needs of some other countries in Latin America. And I think that we have recognized that in the Alliance for Progress. We give a much greater priority to Latin America. We've had some very substantial programs in Brazil, which recently, which Mr. Quadros was not referring to at all. He was referring to the past record, and I don't think there's any difference of view now as between us and Brazil as to the adequacy of our aid program or where Brazil is trying to go economically.
Yeah.
Well, we in the commodity side of this, there were really, I'd say, two major decisions. One of them was that we would be willing to join a proper coffee agreement, and that there will be, as soon as the coffee study group meets next month, that there will be action leading to draw up a new charter for consumer countries to join, and that we would try to help the enforcement of export controls through using import controls for people who are not living up to their to the agreement. The other agreement, we did say that we would consider, and it is being considered now interdepartmentally, whether or not we would join the TIN agreement. That only affects one country, and I don't know whether it's of very great importance in Latin America. The third thing was that we agreed to study carefully in the IAECASOC, and we would join in it, this question of compensatory financing, which is also under study in the United Nations. This is a very difficult problem. If it could work, it would be a very fine solution to what's been a very difficult problem. But frankly, we don't know whether it's workable or not, and all we have done is agree to meet and study very exhaustively with our Latin American friends the possibilities of setting up a fund that would make advances, loans, when exports decline below a certain mean and then be repaid when they increased above it. Similar studies are underway in the UN, but this is we're doing this on the basis just with the Latin Americans, which will contribute to our knowledge and ability to handle the UN problem when it comes up. I think it's next spring for final decision.
There's been much talk about problems, our problems in backing up our pledges from the left wing, such as Congress improving the non-rich lending authority. What are the prospects of the various sectors in Latin America backing their governments in carrying out these social and economic reforms, especially?
I think these two things are very, very much intertwined. When I got down there and had my original conversations with many of the finance ministers, I found a good deal of concern because up to that time there had been no quantification or indication of what might be expected from the outside. And they said they were being asked, which is true, to go back to their countries and ask their parliaments to adopt very difficult laws to achieve very laudable ends, to increase their taxes, to change their land system and so forth, to bring them into a new type of era. But they all knew that that new era would not arrive unless they could count, besides what they did, on some sort of adequate assistance from the world, the outside world, of which the United States, of course, is a big part. So I think the answer to your question is that if they can have reasonable assurance, they will be very greatly strengthened in taking these steps. Now, these steps are already underway. A lot of people sort of feel that not much has been done. That's not so. In many countries, there's been real progress. I just give you two examples. There's a very real program of land reform that's about 50% complete in Venezuela, which is couldn't ask for a better one. Another, talking about taxes, you can take the Argentine. There they've, in the last 2 years, they made a tremendous drive on their tax system. And as a result, this year, the finance minister of Argentine told me, they will collect in taxes without any really substantive changes in their laws over twice what they collected 2 years ago. I think the figure's about 117%. And that shows what can be done by this effort, and it is underway. And that's just those are just two examples. There are plenty more of them.
I understand some in the OAS had a program for using some of the loan money to aid national news agencies and spread it to developed countries. I wonder if there were any discussions at the conference providing
I think that wasn't really discussed there. There were some indications in one of these task forces there might be something like that, might be advisable, but there was pretty unanimous feeling that they didn't want the government to begin to interfere with the press, and so that was dropped rather rapidly.
Secretary,
Yes. I understand the $2 billion. That is a projection of existing money available. How much new money is this plan going to cost over the next 10 years? And what are the controls that this government will have over that to ensure that the Latin American governments live up to the promises they have committed?
Well, the $2 billion is a composite of a lot of things. It's not all existing amounts, although some of it is. Our private investment, for instance, has fluctuated up and down. Last year it was less than the amount we project. The average of the years preceding it was more. So we think this is a reasonable estimate. I don't know of any controls over private investment abroad. The private companies make their investments, and they watch out for them. Well, there are no special controls. The same thing applies to private investments from Europe. The World Bank operates in the same way it always operates. You come back to the $100 million, which I mentioned roughly from United States agencies, and in that there is a reasonable amount for the Export-Import Bank, which would operate just the same way it always has. There is an increased amount for two things, for development lending in Latin America and for the Social Progress Fund, which is done through the Inter-American Bank. Now, the Inter-American Bank follows this setup and sees what's accomplished. And our own Development Loan Fund has the same procedures they have all over the world. In addition to that, there is this special provision for annual reviews each year of the progress each country is making in the IA-ECOSOC, which is sort of like the OEC annual reviews used to be, to see what they're doing to meet the specific goals they've set themselves, which would include land reform, more taxes, and so forth. And there is this committee of experts set up, which is also to judge their programs and see how they progress. So I think that there are very adequate means of keeping track of what's going on without in any way stepping over the line and infringing the sovereignty of these countries.
Secretary, if the Senate House conference comes up with a three-year long-range tribute, will that do the job?
Certainly, if we can make long-term provisions, that's what we need. Now, 5 years is better than three. 3 years, I would say, would be a very minimum. We might be able to persuade the Latin Americans that was a good intent, a good earnest of good intentions, but it wouldn't be anywhere near as good as 5 years. All right, Nan, go ahead.
Inasmuch as the language used in the declaration was, "We will provide," that seems like a fairly firm long-term commitment already.
Well, let me get you the exact language. The United States, for its part, pledges its efforts to supply financial and technical cooperation in order to achieve the aims of the Alliance for Progress. To this end, the United States will provide a major part of the minimum of $20 billion, principally in public funds, which Latin America will require. Now, as I've said before, that we estimated $1.1 billion of public funds and $300 million of private funds. So that comes to $1.4 billion. So there's quite a good margin of error in there to still live up to that that pledge over the period of time. The other provision was that we will provide more than $1 billion in the 12 months, which began on March 13th. That was the pledge made by President Kennedy in his opening address, and some of that is, of course, about half of that's already been furnished. So I think this was a reasonable statement of the fact.
Secretary, I gather that the presence of the Secretary of State indicates that this is a giant
That's right.
economic and political venture. I'm wondering if there is a precedent for a Secretary of Treasury having negotiated a broad agreement with 20 Latin American states.
Well, I can tell you all about the only Preston I know was 4 years ago. I went down to Buenos Aires as deputy undersecretary of state, as the vice chairman of the U.S. delegation headed by the then secretary of the treasury, Robert Anderson, who was very newly in office. He'd only been in office about a week. As a result, he stayed only 3 or 4 days and left, came home. I stayed 3 weeks, and we had some sort of an agreement down there. It wasn't anywhere near the same kind, because we were basically opposed in philosophies, and it was a question of getting an agreement that as nearly as possible reconciled these opposing philosophies. But there it was, certainly the Secretary of the Treasury was the head of the delegation. If he'd wished to stay, I would have been delighted to have him. So would the State Department. So that is a precedent, I'd say.
You do regard this then as not a precedent?
Well, I happen to finish it. You can ask the Secretary of State on that, I'd say.
Well, on that last point, Secretary Dillon was the head of the U.S. delegation, representing the President and the United States, and drawing his authority from the President and his instructions from the President through the Secretary of State. And this is a normal arrangement for United States delegations abroad. I understand that a number of you raised some questions about two matters, and I might comment briefly on those. One has to do with certain acts of violence that have occurred recently in the Dominican Republic, as political dissenting groups have tried to express their own political point of view in recent weeks. The United States government regards many of the moves toward democratization initiated by President Balaguer and the support given them by most elements of the Dominican government and people as a highly constructive manifestation of a genuine desire to create a more meaningful democracy for the Dominican people. I think the incident which the press has been reporting are deeply regrettable, and I assume appropriate investigations are being made. But I hope that the Dominican people will persist in seeking progress through peaceful means, and that the government will protect them in the exercise of the civil rights which are essential to that democracy. There are other questions on the matter of the ship, which is now down at Norfolk, Virginia. It's a little delicate to comment too much on that, because at this very moment there is a court hearing, I understand, in process. But the questions had to do with the nature of the arrangements or deals which might have been made with the government of Cuba on this and related matters. Let me say that there has been no special agreement or deal on these questions. Our government is represented in Cuba. Our interests are represented in Cuba by the Swiss government, and their interests here by the government of Czechoslovakia. What we're doing is applying to these questions well-established principles of law which are available to governments in such situations. It also means that the courts are open to private citizens, so that if property comes into the other jurisdiction and an issue of sovereign immunity is raised, the court will take that into account. It's also true that if some American property turns up in Cuba and there is no valid claim against the owners of that property, we would expect that property to be returned promptly. There has been no discussion of or no compromise of the right of anyone to come to this country to seek political asylum. That question is not involved in this present situation. But the normal and well-established processes of law can handle these problems. We think it's preferable that they do so, and we think they should be handled in order not to let such incidents as hijacking of airplanes become epidemic in character and endanger the life of travelers in the air. I think that's the end of my comment on that point. Yes?
Secretary, on the Berlin issue, now that the last incident in Berlin seems to have reached the conclusion for the moment, and there's been so much talk of negotiation between the East and the West, Is there as yet any discussion among the three Western allies of at least making an approach to the Soviet Union about having future negotiations?
Well, the problem of Berlin, including the problem of negotiations, has been discussed among these Allied governments for some weeks now. Indeed, the discussions began at the time of the aid memoir which we received in Vienna. So that there's nothing, I think, new to add. This question of negotiation is one which is before governments, it is being discussed among them, and will in due course be discussed with the Soviet Union.
Well, is it correct to say then that there's been no impact given to the possibility of negotiation by the closing of the frontier?
I would think the problem of negotiation is independent of that particular episode. Well, I think that is something that will come out in due course as a result of our discussions with governments, including the government of the Federal Republic of China, Germany. Excuse me.
According to latest reports, especially from London, it seems that President de Gaulle is increasingly opposing an approach to the Russians. And according to the last report this afternoon on the ticket, it says that diplomatic officials in London said the United States and Britain, as a result, may feel compelled to move on their own in search of a negotiating framework with the Soviet Union.
Yes, these reports illustrate exactly why we can say so little about negotiations in advance of negotiations. I mean, if the views or attitudes are to be discussed publicly, negotiations become very difficult. I'm not now attesting to the truth or falsity of these particular reports. But discussions are going on among governments, and there will be negotiations, and there will be negotiating positions. But these must be handled with considerable care if they are to be successful.
Mr. Secretary, in this connection, it seems to me that our allies and ourselves are talking about two things. And I didn't mention it. I think Walter Lippmann and the President's papers have been talking about the so-called undeclared policy, which says that a split in Germany is not entirely a bad thing. This is popular among the people of France and of Britain, too, also of Russia. We are going for unification of Germany almost alone. Is this not a thing that is beyond the discussion of negotiations, whether or not we're going to take these positions, if it's not a basic sort of policy split between us and our allies?
I don't find a policy split on that question of self-determination. If you will look at the agreed inter-allied notes, aid memoirs, protests, I think you'll find that the principle of self-determination is fully laid out there, and that was done on a basis of tripartite, quadripartite agreement. I would not myself recognize these deep policy differences which have been speculated about.
Secretary, you've said on several occasions now that there will be negotiations. Do you have assurances from the Soviet Union, formal assurances or otherwise?
No, this is a
they are ready for negotiations?
This is a prediction. When I say that there will be negotiations, I cannot imagine that responsible governments will let this matter come to a very sharply heightened crisis without discussions among them. There indeed have been discussions among governments already. The exchange of notes is itself a part of negotiation, although not a very a productive one in terms of reaching agreement. These public exchanges of notes have indicated the nature of the differences. But there will be negotiations as a matter of, I think, prudent conduct of governmental business.
And you mean beyond exchange notes?
Well, there are many forms in which it might take, yes.
General, play in the future,
No, I have no comment on that. We were delighted that he was able to go to West Berlin with the Vice President. And I recall very vividly the role he played in the first Berlin blockade when I was also in government at that time. But I have nothing on the other point.
Secretary, what is the position of the United States regarding the upcoming conference in Brussels and Belgrade? More specifically, what do you hope
comes? Well, we have not ourselves either encouraged or discouraged governments from attending. This is something which is for them to decide. One of the interesting points will be to see to what extent governments whose principal characteristic is that they, as far as this meeting is concerned, that they do not have sharp commitments to the two major blocs, find elements in common, find that this alone or this feature gives them a common point of view. After all, they're located in different parts of the world in different circumstances, and it'll be interesting to see how that works out. But they each have commitments to their own national interest. They have commitments to the Charter, most of them. And we would suppose that they could have a very very useful meeting there, and we'll be following it, of course, with interest. But we're not participating or trying to influence it. That is itself one of the intriguing questions. Thank you very much.